Ian is well known to you, so I'm not going to run through his CV. He is a National Mental Health Commissioner. He is the head of the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney and has various other roles there. So Ian's going to give us a bit of an overview about the current reforms and the systems, what these changes mean for providers, you know, and for consumers and carers and the community in general. So, it's fantastic to have Ian with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks to Tony, and thanks very much to Sebastian. Unfortunately, can't be here. Sebastian's very keen that the Alliance really take on the issues of mental health along with physical health as part of key structural reform in the Australian healthcare system. And I would commend the Alliance on the fact that it has actually picked up the two issues of Indigenous health and mental health as the subject of today's meeting. Very timely in an election year, and very timely in an election year that undoubtedly will be dominated by economics, to actually discuss really key issues that have their origins and obviously, I would argue, their solutions in the wider social community and context of health. There is a danger, I feel, currently, you can see it in the current tax debate, that we'll go back to the usual Australian healthcare debate, which will be an Australian hospitals debate, and about financing of public hospitals and the tensions there between things like elective surgery in the public and private sector, emergency departments and cancer care, and that will be Australian healthcare, again, to say the last, what I would say, failed Rudd-style reforms eventually brought with Julie Gillard. We've got a national hospitals agreement as a funding agreement. That's usually what we end up with. So there is in the reform argument, I think, a really important issue. Since in chronic disease, you see it in ageing, you see it in child and youth health, you certainly see it in Indigenous health and mental health, a need to have a more sophisticated discussion of health. And health lies within a social context. What you hopefully will hear this year is a Prime Minister talking about mental wealth. It's not a typo, it's actually mental health. And it does pick up some of the themes that Ken Wyatt was discussing, really around what drives participation and the role of health not as a cost, but as an investment. Now, if the chair of the National Commission, Alan Fells, were here, he'd give you a long professor of economics lecture that there's 4% of GDP at stake in the mental health area, and this whole tax nonsense debate we're having at the moment only has 0.5% of GDP at stake. These are much bigger areas. And that's actually many of the ways, I think, in a lot of discussions you have with ministers and other people and other important people, to frame the discussion. Health is not a cost issue. It's a large social and economic investment that we choose to make. And there are areas where it matters. I really liked in Ken's actual presentation the emphasis he had on childhood, mental and physical health, driving school participation, driving productive individuals, leading to resilient communities. You know, that's actually what's the heart of the issue. I'm glad we'll hear about the examples from Congress, actually in Alice Springs, where I think John Boffa and others have talked importantly about the important outcomes that have been achieved. The other issue that's tied up in, first I'll deal with the wealth issue, and I'll come to the implementation, because that's the other issue. I did have the pleasure some years ago of attending a World Economic Forum thing about mental health policy globally and brain and mind sciences. And a very important woman in a very thick German accent, she said, "You're from Australia, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." "You have the world's best mental health policies." I thought, "Oh, well, that's good." "You have the worst implementation of those policies." I said, "Yes, that's us." "Since 1993, we've had the world-winning policies. Canberra is filled with the best documents. We have written the world's best documents." Picking up a point from Carbon in the previous session, however, our track record on implementation. And that's the really big issue. We've had a lot of political commitment at a national level over two decades, nationally over at least a decade. As we have in the Indigenous area, I'd argue, we all want to do better. It's the implementation that knocks us down. So we've got to find new ways forward. We just can't simply, in my view, have the same aspirational statements and yet a fundamental childlike naivety about the implementation in various ways. So as we talk about the mental health and wealth, one of the issues about that is, what is the goal? So when we invest in our area, what are we looking for? We're looking for citizens who are mentally healthy and resilient. We're looking then for participating communities at their local level that actually are resilient and responsible, that allow people to participate economically and socially in a productive way in their lives. Sort of things we share with the disability community and with other communities. It's a community empowered strategy. It's a personally relevant strategy. It's a different approach to what I'd argue is the traditionally patronising approach to healthcare delivery. I was just talking with my great friend Harry Lovelock in the middle there about the role of the professions, and whether the professions and the systems that sit behind them, the hospitals, the doctors, everybody else, has a fundamentally patronising kind of attitude of what we will do for you. which will be good for you. As distinct from, will we create systems that will actually enable you to live long and productive lives? Now, this mental wealth stuff you're going to hear, and hope, and the Prime Minister's really picked it up in launching the government's response to the national report, which I'll talk about. He did make one of his favourite comments that Australia's greatest resource isn't under the ground in Western Australia, sorry, the Western Australians, or in Queensland, or in anywhere else that we dig stuff up and export it. Our greatest resource is in people's heads. It's in our people, and we need to invest in our people. And he, when he was in one of those periods in wilderness, in opposition, wandered across this kind of stuff, which really came out of the UK, about the mental wealth of nations. And the country's got to learn to invest, to capitalise on cognitive resources, what we can do. There's a lot in the prevention areas which are very complex in this area, but some things we do know what to do, which is when you've got a problem to intervene early, that currently they are the most evidence-based things we can do. And that's where the health system becomes relevant, as well as the wider social sets of issues. And that occurs right across the lifespan. There are things we need to do antenatally. There are things we need to do in early childhood. There are things we need to particularly do in adolescence and then in the continuing life in regards to ageing. And this issue of having resourceful citizens and resourceful systems underpins that. So we're really lucky that we actually have, I would say, an economically and socially literate Prime Minister who's actually engaged with this stuff. And the issue becomes, as we have these dialogues about all the systems that we're dealing with, to what extent are we seriously talking about that, that they are productive systems? They're systems people can engage with, they're systems that enable people to have more productive lives. Now, back at the change of government in 2013, there's a lot of dialogue with the previous Prime Minister, who actually had changed his view about mental health substantially during since the time he was actually the Health Minister, when he was less than cooperative on some of the major issues we were trying to champion at that stage, to saying, OK, this stuff really does matter, but I don't want to get into a long dialogue and another big review. We have mental health reviews and human rights inquiries and Senate inquiries, and we've got more reviews than everybody else. And in his rather action man sort of characteristics, he said, just tell us what to do. Also, I don't want to get lost in federal-state relationships. So under Minister Dutton, when the new government came in 2013, the National Mental Health Commission, which had been set up by the Gillard government, and to report annually on outcomes in this area, not more discussion of activity and aspiration, but report outcomes, tell us what we, the Commonwealth government, should really focus on in a leadership role and from the wealth of the nation sort of perspective. So that's the task the National Commission, led by Alan Fells, did in 2014. It had a year to do it. It delivered on time on December 1st, 2014. And then we had the whole of 2015 tied up in the government response. And the government creating other subcommittees and reviews of the review, et cetera, in a marvelous sort of yes minister episode that went on for quite a long time, till the ABC actually leaked the report, and then the government had another committee to review the report or the leak of the report. And then finally in November, we had the government's response to that. Now, the government's actual response, so I'll go into, it's kind of important in a fundamental way to understand the government response is largely based, thankfully, on the Commission's work. The Commission had over 2,000 submissions, engaged with lots of different people. As Adele was saying, it's went to many of the key stakeholders in many of the key areas. I'm always surprised in mental health that anyone can stand, could be consulted yet again and feed into another government report. But they did. They're very cooperative with the Commission with the idea that this was going to actually influence what the government would actually do. It would have an action item attached to it. So it's just worth taking a little while just to say what's in there, because that is actually a lot of the template for what underpins the government response. And then we'll come to where the government response is actually at. So we had this review of the particular thing, the report of the National Commission. There's a, this size volume. If you want to see it, read all four volumes, it runs to 700 pages of stuff. Overall, what you get is, as Tony was alluding to, it's a poorly planned and badly integrated system, massive drain on people's wellbeing and participation, affecting productivity and economic growth. Okay, you can see this economic discourse. We haven't all just suddenly retrained in economics, courtesy of Alan Fells. We do seriously think we've got to be able to say continuously in health and in social services, the way in which we invest as a nation, what do we get back? What does it enable people to actually do? The other big thing it highlighted, and to pick up at a point that I think Carmen was making, there are many, many people in mental health who argue that what we need is more money, and then we'll work out how to do it. I'm no longer of that school, that more money is the answer. Now, this particular report was done under the constraint. The terms of reference were, don't ask for more money, right? They were the terms of reference. So we didn't ask for more money. We didn't go into the relative value of more investment. But I would say the Commission is strongly in the view of saying it's very important for the Commonwealth to understand, and nationally, what we already spend. So the Commonwealth already spends $10 billion a year But the majority of that is in welfare, not actually in health services. If you look at the total spend, you'll see 48.8% is in disability support directly, and then there's also another 10% in carer payments, etc. So when you get into that, about 60% is in welfare, in income support and carer support to people living with chronic illness. So the Commonwealth pays the price on behalf of all of us of people not being able to participate in those particular set of issues. Now, the states and territories spend at least another $20 billion on direct service delivery. Very interestingly, a lot of that is again in family and community services. In fact, in New South Wales, Sebastian did a review in New South Wales, there's much, much more spent in mental health in family and community services than is spent in mental health services in health on an ongoing basis. So lots of us are employed, lots of the professions, lots of others are employed widely in the social and welfare industries that are providing all sorts of support. It's a very expensive chronic care system. A lot of debate about the outcome related to that expenditure. How effective is a lot of that support? But it's big money. So what the Commission said is basically, look, it's expensive, it's debatable, there are gaps, as a consumer representative said recently at one of our national meetings in Adelaide, there ain't gaps, there's chasms. There's areas of tremendous overlap between Commonwealth and state expenditure, and there's other areas where there's just great chasms of failure to meet particular care needs. So have a system that would be better. The Commission was saying, firstly, it needs to be seriously person-centred, and here, Alan's work at the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and I think the philosophy of the National Disability Insurance Scheme is strongly shared in mental health. You know, top-down patronising health systems telling you what to do and what you can have and what you can't have are not really relevant to many complex areas of life, and particularly in this area. They've got to build up from the person and their family up to what you actually require in a fundamental way. Now, that's can be a piece of motherhood, but it actually comes in strongly then to how systems are developed. And you can see this with the National Disability Insurance system, how it is developed. Basically, the system architecture's busted. We've got to think about how we're doing this. Now, if Alan had his way, there'd be a Productivity Commission review. We'd chuck out the whole business model that currently underpins many of the professions and many of the delivery, both through the Medicare system and through our state financing systems, in favour of a more effective architecture. That just we did have a Productivity Commission review of aged care and childcare, etc. In fact, very interestingly, when the Commission was set up under the Gillard government, when Mark Butler was the Minister assisting the Prime Minister, he was also the Minister for Aged Care. We said he was the most important Minister in the country at that stage. He had aged care and mental health, much more important than the General Health Minister. And he had a Productivity Commission running in aged care. He said, I can't stand having two of them running. You know, redoing the whole aged care system is a big enough economic challenge. But really, mental health represents many of the similar issues. It needs really different business models if it's going to succeed. They can't be narrow health models, they can't be narrow social services models, they can't be narrow welfare funders. And essentially, there's got to be a shift in the way funding happens. More upstream, more early intervention, more support, not more late downstream responses to these particular sets of issues. Basically, over time, we need to shift where the investments are, therefore. So the big bit in the middle there is, as is most of the Australian healthcare system, basically we spend most of it in acute care systems around hospital-based centric systems for a small number of people at very high cost, often quite late or in persistent forms of illness. Now, there's an active misrepresentation by many of the professions of what has actually been said about this particular with changing the cost curve over time. The Commission did not recommend taking money out of hospitals. It said over time, new investments to the tune of $1 billion over 5 years, which is only about 2% of the total funding per year, should move to more community-based resources and should move upstream. $1 billion is a nice big number, but actually, if you take it's only $200 million a year and it's out of $10 billion worth of Commonwealth expenditure, that's quite a small number. Needless to say, professions went nuts, states went nuts. I'm a member of the College of Psychiatrists there, and the President immediately said, well, we can't be having any of that. The Minister announced after it got leaked the day before a COAG meeting, well, of course, we can't upset the states by saying anything about the hospitals, so that's off the agenda. One of those knee-jerk, off the back of nowhere, talked up by the professions, played up in the media, attack on public hospitals type debate in the usual federal state nonsense. Most of the people associated with actually that response, I'm sure, hadn't read page one, let alone page two of the actual report underpinning that. And that's one of the, I think, the tragedies of Australian healthcare and Australian healthcare politics. You know, an attack on the hospitals or an attack on the professions or an attack on acute care, as distinct from any serious attempt to get the balance right. Now, mental health, that's clearly a big issue in terms of what we're going to do. Otherwise, we just have this endless asylum discussion. We had hospitals, we have hospitals, we take them away, we build new hospitals. In central Sydney, we've just built the newest, biggest hospital named after our ex-governor. That's our big new investment in mental health, is another big hospital. We just get lost, and then we've got to, building it was expensive enough, now we've got to finance it every year. In fact, on an ongoing basis. And it's contrary, in fact, to our state policy to have more hospital beds. So what the Commission is saying is you've got to have in your head a serious, serious commitment over time that you would rely less on hospitals over time by increasing strategic investment in new spending in those things that lie outside of hospitals, particularly in the child and adolescent area, support, primary health care, etc. And over time, if you were successful, you would see savings, particularly in the welfare sector, because of increased participation, if you were successful. Not you just redistribute or take away from existing hospital sets of issues. So that's the overarching set of architectures. Now, just tied up in that, and in the person-centred area, is another key area which has come to dominate the response, which is the regionality issue. So just was being emphasised in the previous Indigenous presentation, you can have a national goal, but the implementation has to be local. Now, I'm particularly affected by work that was done in Simon Crean's office during a previous government about regional development in Australia. There are effectively about 60 functional regions in Australia, sociologically, economically, and geographically. And everything has to work, fundamentally, economics, communities, healthcare, welfare, in those 60 communities. And they are extremely diverse. And they're not covered by what we commonly call the Commonwealth and States and Territories. It's not one of them. There certainly aren't eight of them, and they don't. It's not an issue of the premiers all lining up with the, or first ministers lining up with the prime minister and coming up with some national solution. It is an issue. Can we seriously pool money, resources, effort, and as emphasised by the previous Indigenous presentation, leadership and collaboration at a regional level to get cooperation? Now, for anyone who's followed the Divisions of General Practice become Medicare Locals, God knows where that name came from, and has now become the PHNs, the Commonwealth over a long period has put its toe and now its foot in the water of some attempt at taking Commonwealth funds regionally. And I think more aggressively, just in the last little while, stepping back from direct Commonwealth service delivery at a regional level, and certainly Commonwealth micromanagement of programs at a regional level. And this is true in mental health as well. Every time we had an initiative in mental health, we got some new program with some small amount of dollars, usually 10 million or something, to be split up through every agency in the country to get $10. And that would be our national program. And then the more the contracting associated with that would often spend six out of the $10 million anyway to sort of deliver the thing on the ground. We have many, many examples of failed micro programs run by the Commonwealth at considerable bureaucratic expense. The Commonwealth, in case you haven't noticed, is in fast retreat from that stuff. So the issue is a financing one. Their mechanism of de jure is clearly primary health networks. Now, there are 31 of those. There aren't 60 regions, so there is a problem that many of the primary health networks don't actually respond to the geography and social characteristics of the country. But the sub-regions do. And a lot have good track records, particularly in rural and regional Australia, of working more effectively in communities. And many have actually quite long leadership actually in mental health. They're not entirely new to the business. Not the membership's not entirely new to the business. So there's a big opportunity in there. So what we're saying is that the Commonwealth's got a number of issues, and mental health and the funding and what's become the movement of all of the programs, like the Indigenous program, much of the Headspace programs, early psychosis programs, around of everything else the Commonwealth's had under its budgetary wing, has been bundled up and put to the PHNs as the funding mechanism. So this is a serious attempt to move at least $300 million, but probably more in the order of $500 million to that PHN framework. Now, that doesn't mean it's simply up to the PHN leadership to decide what happens to all that stuff. On the other hand, we've also seen the end of sort of micromanagement. The Commonwealth's not exactly telling people what they will do. It doesn't come with a template, or worse, a contract template that says do this, fill in the names, hand out the money, which is what most programs have come with before. It's a seriously open process. Now, a lot of people are very anxious about this. I'm from the anxiety business. I think this is good. You know, a little anxiety improves performance. Overwhelming anxiety, everyone panics and goes to water. But some anxiety improves performance. This is the best structural opportunity, in my view, that we've had for local leadership ever. But it's anxiety provoking because the answer is not clear. The answer will not be the same in those 60 regions of Australia, and neither should it be. The local leadership characteristics will be different, the geography will be different, the demography is very different, there are different answers. The childhood solution in Congress in Central Australia is a standout example of focusing on maternal and child health, etc., to get school participation. An outcome. That is one of the few examples I know of in the country where anyone's ever measured the outcome. And it's clear that the cognitive and emotional investment is to drive school participation, have kids school ready, because otherwise there's no chance of what will happen. A lot of discussion with Indigenous leaders locally, a lot of planning, very specific. That's really rare. Mainly just pour money into programs, hoping something like that might magically happen. So this is where the roles and responsibilities comes to play. We're focused on the person, but what is actually the mechanism? So just within that, the Commission made recommendations. The Commonwealth's role is leadership, but it's not to tell every regional and rural community what to do. Big mistake. Now, the open question is, does the leadership exist to actually do it? And will the leadership be sufficiently representative, inclusive, get it right? In discussion with a number of PHNs around the country, some see themselves as talking to a number of different audiences. There is that which sees as GP divisions and GP-centric things growing up to become the primary care of the agency. Big mistake if that's the outcome. On the other hand, there are within communities, non-government organisations, community leadership, partnerships that do already exist, that if they step up to the mark, they will at the end of the day make the decisions and the accountabilities. There will, the assumption is, from the Commonwealth and from the leadership in the area, from templates there and youth mental health and suicide prevention in other areas, Indigenous health from the national committees, be guidance, be ideas about what actually sort of thing that does work. And there does need to be investment in does it work. Our big failing in this area, and Sebastian was here as a PhD in the whole topic, of the lack of accountability. We've had 20 years of action under national plans, and just those from the Commission and others know well, I might suddenly break down because we're about to have another fifth plan. The Commonwealth bureaucracy and the state bureaucracies are madly rushing to the fifth national mental health plan with no evidence the previous four changed that much. And there'll be no agreement about the outcomes to be desired, but it's the process that AMAC requires, and we're going to get it whether we want it or not. Some of us think not. What we want is a serious accountability. So at the primary care level, at the regional level, we've got to have some clear focus on what is it that is trying to be achieved and some serious measurement about is it being achieved as people go about the task somewhat differently. Not randomly, hopefully using evidence-based elements, hopefully using the best, and hopefully bringing new players into play. So that's the second issue we've gone to, is agree national targets and local performance measures. If there is no measurement of the outcome, it's another and completely wasted exercise in bureaucratic reorganisation, for which we're famous. I have a very old friend in her late 80s now, who says in healthcare she's now lived through five cycles of centralisation and decentralisation of everything. Every time there's a crisis, you either decentralise or centralise, depending on where you are in the process. You rearrange the bureaucracy to see if it goes out any different. Since no one knows whether it's any different, and people are still complaining about the gaps, you go and do it again. On a particular kind of way. Now, this is a decentralisation cycle, no doubt about it. But if there's no performance measurement, it'll be a waste of time. We went for a small number of targets. There should be some small, specific kind of areas. We care about suicide numbers regionally. We care about attempted suicides. We care about whether people with mental health problems live particular lives. I care whether they smoke or they don't smoke as the principal outcome, not some wide agreement about improving health access for people with mental health problems, with no idea about whether their life expectancy will change or not in particular sets of areas. So working on some specific targets to achieve particular areas. There are issues about, for example, employment of young people with mental health problems that I'll come to as another particular example. Okay, so we have overtly said over time hospitals are not the answer. And I wish other people in the healthcare reform business would actually seriously stop people saying that. Even Paul Keating the other day, referring to the GSTs, talked about Australian hospitals. The word hospital suddenly replaced healthcare. Even really smart people just think it's a matter of the hospital system being the thing that we have to fund, and that's what lies at the bottom of our taxation base. So, we were saying, look, over time, $1 billion, which is $200 million a year, the Commonwealth's $10 billion or the nation's $30 billion, is not a lot, but that's the sort of money you could invest over time. There's the empowering people to do more in these areas. And that basically one of the most important things is the biggest spender and the biggest growing spender in the mental health expenditure bucket of the Commonwealth is the Better Access Program, which was brought in originally in 2001 as my preferred thing, Better Outcomes, but that got done in by politics, by the professions, to become in 2006 called Better Access, because who gets paid? The provider. Whether there's better access is a matter of moot point. For the $1 billion we spent, there's arguments with about 5% more people might actually be getting care for a $1 billion investment. Been good for the professions, no doubt about it. Whether it's been good for the outcomes, a bit more debatable. Now, really importantly, that's a big Medicare number, $500 million a year, increasing, uncapped. What the Commonwealth has said in response is, you know what? We could cash that out. People could decide, like the National Disability Insurance Scheme, is either to see someone individually, a psychologist, psychiatrist, whoever they like, and get the Medicare rebate, or a provider could cash out those payments and provide a multidisciplinary team, could provide a care option that was not simply determined by the provider, but might respond. It might include education, employment support, it might include housing support, it might include a mental health nurse or a nurse attending to physical health along with other mental health problems. Now, I'll come to this, is a key other structural issue. For that to succeed, you can't rely on the classic small enterprise of a GP practice or a psychology practice or an individual health provider, a specialist practice, which is underpinned our Medicare system. That requires medium-sized enterprises, medium-sized businesses like Congress or others to organise that stuff and then cash out not just one individual payment for a bunch of people, a bunch of payments to do that particular thing. When you start to go to these provider-type models, when you go to a PHN, you say you're not the provider, you're the actual funder. They've got to be able to purchase something different from somebody. If all we do here is a big churn, like the GST, if all we do is take all this available money, put it back through PHN and hand it out to the same people who are getting it the first time around, all we've done is increase the bureaucracy in the churn to get exactly the same outcome. Many of the professions simply want to know, am I going to get funded the same way I got funded? My behaviour doesn't have to change, does it? Here I want to cause even more anxiety. Now, I want them to panic. I do want the professions to panic. And a significant number, particularly the younger ones who are in education and development, to have experiences in multidisciplinary teams, in medium-sized enterprises that are doing social good, work alongside other professionals to have the experience of behaving differently. And then you need sophisticated organisations to do that. Big challenge in Australia as to whether we've got it. In the Commission report, there's an emphasis on the child development, healthy start to life, making early investments. It's been noted there's a big emphasis, and the Commission is deeply committed to the issue of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, and so Pat and Tom's efforts in there are critical. It is a critical question. Does that $85 million get spent effectively through local leaderships in each group, or does it become a waste of money like everything else, or worse, doesn't actually get spent in the area? Suicide prevention is big and a big focus of the particular area, and it is unclear at this stage what the Commonwealth really intends to do about suicide prevention. It hasn't taken up our specific recommendations about whole community approaches in regional levels, and there are workforce sets of issues that are important. One of the other big issues, and Ken alluded to this in his presentation, which is really, really different now and worth emphasising, is the role of technology. So we have some of the best developments in innovative technology in the country. We have a Prime Minister who wants to do technology. We have digital transformation officers in education, health, science. The worst person for technology is health. We're tied up in electronic medical records and transfer of records from doctors to hospitals and back again. No understanding of the tremendous opportunity that's talked about. So this is one of the other big open sort of items. A lot of enthusiasm, and I'm one of them. I'm part of several organisations that are part of. Actually, you go online, you get help, you start to manage, you use monitoring devices, you take control through the technology, low cost, high access, as long as you've got digital connection, that might matter. This is one of the big, important growth areas. Just to come to what happens, public support. There is wider public support. Mental health, like Aboriginal health, is not only an issue of aspiration. The community supports it. What it doesn't get is the how to do it and why government gets lost on the journey along the way. So I think like the Indigenous area, what we need to be in, and people at your own alliance need to be in, is the solution business. I don't think we have to advocate that things be done, but we have to advocate for effective solutions. So picking up Tim's point, what is it we actually want? That's the thing. Like, we don't just want to close the gap. We just don't want people with mental health problems to live longer lives or be more effective. It's the how. And are we on the side of actual reform, or are we on the side of just the usual nonsense that has constituted the process over the last 20 years? So what we're about, and to take the young person kind of example we're involved in, is being very specific about the outcomes. We don't want people to get worse. We want people to economically participate. We want to reduce self-harm and accidents and injuries. We want to have secondary prevention problems where mental health is tied with substance abuse, and we want better physical health outcomes, right? We're very clear, small number of things that really matter, and measure them regionally and respond. The second big thing is whatever you do, it is personalised. We don't need the genetic revolution to personalise our care. We just actually need to treat people individually. They've got complex illnesses. That's what the National Disability Insurance Scheme is aiming to do. We've got to make that central to the health scheme, particularly to mental health. And then there is an issue about how do you get to scale? How do you actually take these things that are evidence-based and deliver them? Now, our answer to that would be through regional organisation and through things like smart technologies, that's actually the way you do it. You don't do it by sitting here wherever the hell we are in Canberra, Northbourne Avenue, and sending out directives to do it this way according to this template. Fails repeatedly, bad spend on an ongoing basis. Now, I would say what's been good in the government response, as I'm getting the get-off bit now, is the Prime Minister has responded. The Prime Minister's taken responsibility. There are other key people like Arthur Sinodinos, who was key to the Howard government reforms in this area, take the area very seriously. There's a serious economic agenda. We need to be part of that. A structural problem has arisen since Abbott took over as Prime Minister, which is the National Commission no longer sits in Prime Minister and Cabinet. It sits in health. And health is always a problem because it spends money. And we're not the most important thing in health. There's always something more important in health. Cancer care, new virus, healthcare stuff. We're serious long-term social and economic welfare reform. That's where we belong. What we need is the healthcare agencies and the serious healthcare alliance agencies in their conversations with the Commonwealth to be focused on these issues. These are where the big things are. There are solutions. They need to be implemented regionally and locally. That requires the PHN bit, the Commonwealth bit, and the local health district and the non-government organisations to work together. And my last bit is, it needs the professions to behave responsibly as agents of change. Thanks.